From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Right now, all Americans, once they turn 65, can expect at least one thing: equal access to Medicare. But that could soon change in a significant way. The 38-year-old program is the biggest government entitlement to come out of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society era. Now it's facing bankruptcy. To help save Medicare from insolvency, Congress is considering shelving the program's need-blind founding principle in favor of a new one, means testing, where rich seniors pay more for Medicare services. Crossing that line has always been taboo. It's a fundamental philosophical change with potentially huge implications for American support of government entitlements like Medicare and Social Security. Tonight on Point, sizing up seniors' wallets with means testing for Medicare. We begin tonight in Washington, where Congress has been trying to hammer out the final details of a massive Medicare reform package. Julie Rovner is health policy correspondent for NPR and joins us live. Good evening, Julie Rovner.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Julie, give us a sense of what's going on. President Bush has been pounding the podium this week saying we've got to have Medicare reform completed. What's on the table?
Well, just about everything's on the table, and that may be what's taking so long. Basically, the standoff that you have is you have conservative Republicans who say, yes, we're willing to add a prescription drug benefit to Medicare, but only if you make changes to shore up the program's financing for 78 million baby boomers who will start becoming eligible in the year 2010. Democrats are saying, we've got time to deal with that. Let's do the drug benefit first. So you've got this kind of balance. You've got a lot of these sort of cost containment ideas that the Republicans are floating that the Democrats don't like. Basically, you've got 12 people in a closed room that reporters are standing outside of trying to come up with a bill that can get enough conservative votes in the House without losing too many Democratic votes in the Senate. And so far, they're having a very difficult time doing that.
Now, when the Republicans say, Julie, that they want to shore up the numbers first, is that where President Bush's notion of having some privatized element of Medicare comes into play?
Absolutely. I mean, they're talking also a little bit about some other types of cost containment, perhaps, if not caps, maybe signals that when Medicare starts to get too big, Congress might have to come back and do something. But basically what they're hoping is that perhaps more private competition could hold down costs. Now, I have to say there's not a whole lot of evidence that that will happen, but that's certainly what they're pinning their hopes on, and that's why they're talking about so much about some of these private plans.
Now, means testing is also on the table, and I guess the idea there is that seniors who have more money would pay more for some Medicare services. Can you outline for us what's being considered?
Yeah, well, now there's two different kinds of means testing. Literal means testing, which they're talking about for very low income Medicare beneficiaries, basically means that if you are too wealthy, you don't get a benefit. So when we talk about real means testing, we're talking mostly about Medicaid. In the case of the Medicare bill, they're talking about how the drug benefit would work for low income people. They would get special help. There's an asset test there that's part of the means test, that if you have low income but too many assets, you wouldn't get any help.
So that comes into play as part of the welfare kind of dynamic that we know well. The new element here is looking at people who have more money and saying, you're going to have to pay more.
Indeed.
How much more?
Well, that's what they call income relating. Mm-hmm. It's not strictly means testing, but basically what they're saying and where they seem to be, and again, this is all very tentative, but where they seem to have landed is that for people who make more than about $80,000 a year, right now Medicare is two parts, hospital part A, which everybody gets automatically when they turn 65 if they're eligible for Social Security. Part B is an optional program. You pay a premium. That premium is 25% of what it costs. General tax revenues pay the other 75%. What they're saying is that for people who make more than $80,000, they'll get the same benefits, but instead of paying a premium that's 25%, they'll pay the reverse. They'll pay 75%. The government will pay 25%, which would basically triple their premium. That's been floated before. It's been suggested before by Democrats and Republicans. It actually has bipartisan support. But again, as you mentioned in the beginning, it's a dramatic, fundamental change for the way Medicare has worked.
And to really understand this, Julie, as I read it here, over time, the percentage of those payments that affluent seniors would pay would rise.
It certainly could. Now, there are those who point out that Medicare is already income-related, that the wealthy already pay more for Part B by virtue of the fact that the wealthy pay more in income taxes. Since Part B is 75% funded by income taxes, those who earn more are already paying more because they're subsidizing themselves. That's certainly one of the arguments against this. Obviously, the argument for it is that you've got 78 million baby boomers coming in, and why should moderate and low income working people subsidize wealthier older people.
At this point, Julie, what's your sense on this angle in particular, means testing or income relating? Does it look like it has enough support to be part of a final package?
It's interesting. The Senate actually voted for this in a test vote when it was going through the Senate back in June. They had, in the sort of the strange procedural way the Senate works, they voted to kill it, and the vote to kill it failed. It got sort of 59 senators said, no, we want this. What normally happens in that situation is that they then turn around and pass it by voice vote. Before they could do that, Ted Kennedy stood up, who obviously is a key, I would say the key vote in this entire operation, because it was his support for this bill that got so many Democrats to join them. And he said, if you put this in, he didn't say, I'm not going to vote for the bill. What he said was, we're not going to pass this bill tonight. I'm going to stand here and talk. He doesn't like it. He's made it very clear that he doesn't like it. If they want his vote, it needs to not be in here. On the other hand, there's a lot of conservatives who think it's important. There are a lot of Democrats, other than Kennedy, who support it. So where this comes down is not at all clear. What is clear is that it would certainly make Ted Kennedy not happy, and in the balance of finding enough votes for this bill, that would probably not be a good thing.
And top level, at the top rung here, Julie, is there going to be Medicare reform? The president wants it. He wants drug coverage. Is he going to have a reform package that he can go into the campaign with? What are the odds?
Well, I think the odds, certainly for this bill for this year, even the people in the room who keep coming out every day and saying, we're making progress, we're making progress, we're making progress, think it's really only 50-50. It's just extraordinarily large, extraordinarily difficult. Now, I think it's entirely possible if this effort kind of tanks, which it could, that they could come back next year and do something smaller, perhaps do something limited to those people with low incomes and very high drug costs, people who really need it, sort of abandon the idea of trying to have something for everyone. At this point, they're saying, oh, no, we won't do that. There is no plan B. This is the only thing. But there's also no exit strategy, and at the moment, they're just kind of spinning their wheels.
Julie, thanks for all your coverage there, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Not a problem.
Julie Rovner is health policy correspondent for NPR. She spoke with us from Washington. We're talking tonight about means testing and the future of Medicare and maybe one day of Social Security. Both programs are in deep trouble. Both need new solutions. So, should affluent Americans who have paid in all their lives now pay more or get less when it's time to tap these bedrock entitlements? Should an affluent retired investment banker pay more for Medicare services than a grandmother trying to get by on a tiny income? Should billionaires Warren Buffett and George Soros, or Bill Gates once he turns 65, receive the same coverage at the same price as middle-income and low-income seniors? If Medicare is about to go under, is breaking the means testing taboo a good way to help save the program? Or does it violate a fundamental social contract? Might it ultimately put the programs themselves in jeopardy? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Washington is Robert Reichauer, president of the Urban Institute and a longtime observer of all these things. Good evening and welcome, Robert Reichauer.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Washington is Dean Baker, co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean Baker, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack. Jack, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Good. Good to have you, Jack. Dean Baker, maybe you'll be good enough to walk us in here. Means testing, or as Julie Rovner is describing it, income relating, is on the table now more prominently than it's been in a long time and maybe ever. Why is there such a big philosophical focus on this? What's the taboo been about charging people with more money, more for such services?
Let me back you up for a second.
Okay.
In your introduction, you referred to Medicare as facing bankruptcy. You said that both Medicare and Social Security are facing deep troubles and need new solutions. And then you said Medicare is about to go under. I'm afraid you haven't been looking at the numbers. If you look at the Medicare trustees report, the program is falling through the year 2027, even if we do nothing. In the case of Social Security, 2042, even if we do nothing. Now, I'm very familiar with, you know, what the longer-term trends are. There are definitely problems, but in fact, if you look at what those programs, both Social Security and Medicare, have looked like since they've been in their inception, that's actually a better situation than they've been in at just about any point in their history.
So you challenge the whole premise?
I would encourage you to be more cautious in this, because let me just put it this way.
Yeah.
If you spoke about Microsoft that way, their lawyer would be calling you in 3 seconds, and you'd be facing a libel suit.
Well, what we've been told here again and again is that by the time the baby boomers make it through the python, there's just not enough there to cover. Is that wrong?
Well, we will be facing a shortfall, but guess what we've done in years past? We've raised taxes. We did it, you know, we did it in the 80s, we did it in the 90s, we did it in the 70s. That's been done in the past. Odds are because we're living longer and health care costs are rising, we'll do that in the future as well.
So we'll grant you there are real time horizon definitions that need to be made here, and point taken, and it's a good point. Yeah, these are huge programs, and it takes a long time to turn these ships and to get the fiscal situation righted if it's not in good circumstances. I guess that's why there's so much focus on this in all the campaigns and right now on Capitol Hill.
Well, again, you know, I don't want to detract from the issue at hand and means testing, but I just want to point out that the problems these programs are facing presently are not qualitatively differently than problems they would have faced in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. In other words, we could have had this conversation, talked about the programs in pretty much the same way we are now at any point in the last, you know, basically since Medicare's been in existence or Social Security's been in existence.
Well, the boomers come on. What about this basic fundamental principle of means testing and how it figures in here?
Okay, people try to put this as a philosophical issue. I really think it's just more a pragmatic issue. I think this is sort of a backdoor way to try and dismantle the program, because the point about means testing is that if you're putting your cap, I heard 80,000, I don't know the inside scoop, let's say, I heard earlier 100,000, let's say it's 80,000.
We've seen both, 80, 100, where it might start.
But you're talking about a very small segment of seniors, you know, at the 80 figure, maybe 5% of seniors are up there. The amount of money that you could look to get from these people has almost no bearing on the future of the program. In part, particularly because they tend to be a healthier group of seniors, some of these people simply opt out. You know, this won't be a good deal for them. So you're not going to get enough money to really affect the finances of the program in a fundamental way. The only reason why someone would propose means testing is a crack in the door, so that you start at 80, then you end up with a shortfall somewhere down the road, and you go, well, let's make it 70, let's make it 60, let's make it 50. And pretty soon you're hitting large segments of the middle class, because that's the only way you raise enough money for it to really make a lot of sense. Furthermore, just as a practical matter, it's extremely difficult to impose a means test because it's very easy. You know, these are retirees almost by definition, most of them at least, and it's very easy to shift your assets from assets that produce income that would be counted against a means test, like a home, like renting a place, the stock, to buying a home, buying a second home, so that you have assets that, you know, do not produce an income and won't count against the means test. And, of course, it's done all the time. So this is why, you know, a lot of economists, just on purely pragmatic grounds, just say you're not going to raise a lot. You're going to encourage, if not fraud, just gaming of the system. So, you know, unless the point is to really take away the benefit for large segments of the middle class, it doesn't do anything.
So you don't see it so much a philosophical question as you put it, a backdoor approach to actually dismantling a program. Robert Reichardt, but there has been historically a kind of commitment not to go to means testing, hasn't there?
Well, with respect to Medicare, you're right, but we have to keep in mind that Part A, the part of Medicare that covers hospital bills, upper-income people pay more into that than lower- and middle-income people. And so the contribution people have made to make themselves eligible for the exact same benefit in Part A has varied by income. The question we have is, should we do more or less the same thing with the component of Medicare that covers doctor's bills, lab fees, durable medical equipment? Right now, as Julie said, we ask participants to chip in a monthly premium, which covers 25% of the cost. The general taxpayer picks up the other 75% of the cost. The issue here is whether it might make sense to ask those who are quite well off to pay a little more than 25% of the cost of this component of Medicare. No one's asking them to pay 100% of the cost. Having them have a slightly less subsidized benefit would be good. Good in the sense that over the long run, this program is going to need more resources or is going to have to spend less. And what we should be doing is asking, how does this option stack up against the alternatives of raising the premium for everybody, low, middle, and upper income across the board.
Robert Reichauer, hold the thought there. We're talking tonight with Robert Reichauer, Dean Bacon, our own Jack Beatty, about Medicare, maybe Social Security one day, and means testing higher income Americans paying more for government entitlements. What do you think? Can we charge higher income Americans more for those entitlements without breaking public support for universal programs? I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Medicare and maybe Social Security one day and means testing, that is, higher income Americans paying more for government entitlements. You can join the conversation tonight. Should affluent seniors pay more for Medicare? Should they one day get less from Social Security if they don't need it? Is means testing fair? And if entitlement programs don't treat all Americans equally, will they survive? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Washington by Robert Reichauer, president of the Urban Institute, former director of the Congressional Budget Office, and also from Washington, Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and our own Jack Beatty in Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, this is a long tradition that's suddenly up for grabs. The Wall Street Journal says it's, quote, reactionary liberals who are worried about it, just opposing change of any kind, even when big change may be needed. How do you see this whole question?
Well, first of all, you couldn't find anybody who supports these programs more strongly than I do. People like my parents who worked hard all their lives and who gave just about everything they had for the education of their children could not have retired in dignity without these programs. These programs are essential to our civilization. Having said that, you know, the dirty little secret of these progressive programs is their regressive financing, the payroll tax. Something like approaching a third of Americans pay more in that tax than they do in income taxes. And in fact, the tax, the progressive income tax now takes a lower level of the federal of GDP since any time since 1941, whereas the payroll tax, which hits heaviest on low-income workers, young people, rose to its highest share of federal revenue ever. So you look at this and you recognize that this tax is punishing for young people, and then you say, well, where is the tax going? Well, we just heard it in that introduction. I mean, it's a sort of comic way of putting it, but it is going to George Soros and these other people. And you know, somebody, some Democrat, sometime is going to come along and say, wait a minute, what about cutting this tax that is so oppressive, is a flat tax basically? What about cutting this tax on young people and poor people so they don't have to have, can bear less burden, and can all, and or can talk about, wait a minute, what about cutting it at the top end so that this doesn't become so
Jack, you know, you're saying yes, let Bill Gates pay more for his Medicare coverage?
I am indeed. I mean, I think that we've got to do something about this tax. This tax, I think, is punishing President Roosevelt, you know. His people put it to him. They said, look, this is more conservative, this Social Security scheme financed by payroll taxes, than any other welfare state. Don't do this. Other welfare states pay it out of general tax revenue. And he said, no. He said, I guess you're right on the economics. But those taxes were never a problem of economics. He said, they are politics all the way through. We put those payroll contributions there so as to give the contributors a legal, moral, and political right to collect their pensions and their unemployment benefits. With those taxes in there, no damn politician can ever scrap my Social Security program.
Well, so there's a foundation for all this consideration. But Dean Baker, the whole idea of means testing was something that, as we understand it, nobody wanted to see come in here because the idea was that it would be a kind of poison pill, that Americans wouldn't support a program if they didn't all benefit from it in some measure equally.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great thing about Social Security and Medicare. They're not seen as welfare programs. They're seen as programs that people pay into. They pay for a benefit, and they're entitled to it when they retire. You know, just as, you know, I think of Social Security, the money that I expect to get back on Social Security when I retire, I just, like if I own a government bond, I expect that I'll get the interest on it, and when it comes due, I'll get the bond back. And, you know, that's the way people understand it, and I think that's a good thing. The other part, let me just correct a couple things that Jack said. One, the Medicare Part B that we're discussing here, that is paid for by the income tax. So that's not coming out of people's payroll taxes. That's coming from George Soros' pocket. Second point, again, I just encourage people to look at the numbers, because if we're talking about putting a means test on people earning above $80,000 or $100,000, let's make it $80,000, we're not going to be able to cut anyone at the low-end taxes, maybe one-tenth of one percentage point. They aren't going to notice that. If we really want to lower their taxes, you want to lower their taxes 2 or 3 or 4 percentage points, we're going to have to means test everyone probably above $20,000.
So you really see it all as a matter of subterfuge, as a way of getting a handle on this Medicare system and maybe in some dimensions taking it down.
Well, those numbers speak for themselves. I don't think you'll find anyone that will tell you very different numbers on that. I mean, it's straight arithmetic. It just doesn't add up. If we're just talking about getting people at the very top end, that's chump change.
But Robert Reichauer,
no, Dean yes. is basically right that what we're talking about is here $3 to $5 billion a mm-hmm. year. But
the drug program alone would cost $400 billion. So it's really small money.
Well, that's 400 over 10 years, and yep. there's a lot more besides drugs involved in that piece of legislation. And really, this has absolutely nothing to do with a prescription drug benefit. What this really has to do is, as you said earlier, trying to shore up the long-run financing of the program. Dean is right that this would affect, in its current form, 5-6% of the elderly, the very richest elderly. If the threshold wasn't indexed gradually over a 20- or 30-year period, it might end up requiring somewhere close to a third of the elderly to contribute a little more than the 25% that they do now, and the fiscal consequences would be more important.
You mean by bringing down that asset level or income level from 100 to
80? No, if you just held it at $80,000, the threshold at which you began paying, and remember, in all these formulations, the individuals with incomes below the threshold, $80,000, pay for 25% of the cost of the program,
right?
And then the person with, let's say, $80,000 to $90,000 of income might pay 29%, and it slowly goes up to a higher fraction.
Yep.
The more income you have, up to $200,000 incomes. Well, these are very, very rich individuals who can easily pay for it, as can probably the top third of the elderly. We're asking ourselves, what steps can we take over the long run to shore up this program? And we can raise general revenue, as Dean suggests, raise the income tax, but we're having a hard time now covering education, roads, defense, and the other needs with the income tax revenue. Mm-hmm. We can cut benefits, but nobody would like that. We can impose higher deductibles and coinsurance on the elderly, and that would hit the sick elderly, and that would be terribly unfair. Or you can raise premiums across the board. These are all unpleasant options. Mm. And the question is, which of them is least unpleasant?
But when Dean Baker looks at this, he sees a kind of attack on the program itself, ultimately. Do you not see that? I mean,
I really don't share that at all, because we're talking about still providing all participants with a subsidy. They're getting something that they aren't paying for. That's fine. I think that's important. It builds, solidarity. I don't think, as Dean said, that this either dismantles the program, or anybody with, any sense at all would ever opt out of the program if you raised, for these rich people, the premium to cover 80% of the cost. It'd still be a tremendously good deal for them. They couldn't find anything on the private market that came anywhere close to as good a deal.
Dean Baker, Ted Kennedy aside, there are very prominent Democrats putting their hand up for this. California Senator Dianne Feinstein said, "My philosophy is that if you can afford it, you should pay for it. The government can't be all things to all people. Why should some middle-income taxpayer subsidize a millionaire's health care costs?"
Well, I see it very similar, saying, Ross Perot, we found out in the 1992 campaign, had an awful lot of money in government bonds. Why should a middle-income taxpayer pay the interest to Ross Perot on his bonds? Well, he bought them, he paid for them, that was the deal. So, the fact that he's very rich doesn't mean he shouldn't get the interest on his bonds, and I think of these programs the same way. And, when Bob is going through the various options, I'd add, uh, uh, I'd t- touch that again. You know, I'm all for getting back some more tax money from higher income people. I think it's a much better way to get the money from them than on this means test. And I can go into some more of the details as to why I think that's a bad deal. But the other point that I think should get mentioned in this context is one of the main reasons we're seeing the prospect of rising Medicare costs is simply we have rising health care costs, and that's something that's really not shared with any other nation in the world. We already spend about 14% of our GDP on health care. The average for other rich nations is about 8%.
So how does it relate to this question?
Well, because that's driving health, that's driving Medicare costs. We don't have two health care systems. We have one health care system, and about half of the expenses are paid through public sector programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and other government insurance programs. And if we don't get a handle on our health care system, then we have huge problems with programs like Medicare, but we also have huge problems with the private sector, growing uninsured population, and larger premiums, out-of-pocket expenses borne even by people who have insurance.
Jack Beattie, join us here. It's interesting. People kind of poo-poo the philosophical question here, but then as the conversation goes forward, it comes back around to that. If you do this, you may begin to unravel support for the program itself, and you're back to first principles.
Well, that's what people have been saying throughout my lifetime, and it's a kind of shibboleth, which isn't to say that couldn't begin to happen. I mean, you can imagine, you know, as in any insurance scheme, that if you let the well-off out of it, you lower the support for the program, you lower the amount of money that's in the program. But I just come back, and I guess I wanted Dean to respond to this, if he would, to this tax, Dean. What about this regressive Social Security, and I'll leave Medicare. You're right, Part B comes from income tax, but just to this basic idea that most of the entitlements come out of this regressive tax that is punishing for millions of American low-income workers. What can be done there?
Well, look, I would love to see a more progressive tax structure for Social Security and Medicare, but, you know, I don't see anything on the table that gets us there. And by cutting the benefits, I'm you know, a little bit at a loss. As I say, you know, again, I keep referring people to the arithmetic. You could take away benefits at the high end, and that doesn't really change the story. I should also point out with Social Security, by the way, it's a very, very progressive payback formula. So if you have someone who's basically been working as a minimum wage worker throughout their working lifetime, they're going to get back about 90% of their average wage, whereas, you know, you have someone who's been paying in at the maximum, you know, they've had an average income of, let's say, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year, they're going to end up getting back, you know, somewhere around 30% of their average wage. It's a very, very progressive payback formula, keeping in mind that, you know, they both paid in the same percentage of their wage through their working lifetime. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though we don't have, I mean, you can call it means testing if you like, but it has the same effect. So we already have a very progressive payback structure. But again, it's, you know, this is why, I mean, I don't know if you want to call this a principle, but the numbers don't make sense. And the situation Bob was talking about, I mean, I understand that, and I think that's partly the story here. But what he's saying, in effect, just to be clear, if we freeze, let's say, 80,000 is the point where you start facing the means test,
the threshold,
threshold, as we go through, you know, 30 years out, we have higher incomes. So 80,000, and again, we're not adjusting for inflation now, so
right.
80,000 30 years out is something like 35,000 is today. So it's a backdoor way of doing that. Now, maybe we think that's a good thing, but we should just be clear what we're doing. We're not putting a means test for George Soros. We're putting a means test on the teacher, the firefighter, someone who had a decent-paying job, not the richest person in the world, a decent-paying job, a decent retirement income, and that's who's paying the means test. So we're not getting, you know, the rich folks here. That doesn't. There's no money there.
It doesn't stay there.
Let me just interrupt
yes,
a minute and talk a little bit about history. Right now, all people, the low-income people, the middle-income people, and George Soros, are paying 25% of the costs of Part B Medicare.
By design. That's the way the plan is designed.
When the program was established in 1966, the law said that the premiums should be 50% of the cost of Part B, and they were for the first 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a precedent that we charged everybody half of the cost of this program.
But it was everybody the same.
Dean, with all due respect, back then, health care costs were lower, I admit, but real incomes were a lot lower, too, particularly for the elderly. And, you know, if what we did back in 1965 when we passed this and then implemented it in 1966 was acceptable, there's no reason why we can't make a rather substantial change now and it would be no different.
But everybody paid the same in those days. It wasn't based on income or threshold.
No, precisely. And here we're suggesting that we don't even go back to that.
But Bob, we have 100 different ways to get more money out of higher income elderly. Suppose we made it 50% again and gave subsidies to those at the bottom.
Robert Reichard, Dean Baker, hold on. I want to welcome our callers into this conversation. Ruth is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I'm one of those people that my income is low enough that the threshold is a golden ring that I will never reach. And so the way I perceive it is that every dollar I make, I pay the taxes, you know, to support this program on. Yet there are people who get above a threshold who don't have to pay taxes on every dollar they make.
On Social Security
That's
after a certain
Security,
point.
Social Security, not right. Medicare.
Yeah, but still, in the whole realm of considering means testing, we take the point.
Exactly. And there's so many other ways that when you have money, you get money. Where I have to pay for checking because I don't have $500 in my checking account, and where I can't get a loan at the rate that other people who have money can get a loan at, and they're not ever crying about that kind of means testing.
So you're saying, let's do it. Let's go ahead and charge the more affluent more for these services.
Cry me a river. Yeah, exactly.
But are you afraid that it will turn around and end up eroding the program itself, Ruth? It won't even be there one day.
No, I don't think that's true at all, because there's not enough of them. There's so few that are making so much. But I just don't see that as being something that's going to erode the program.
Ruth, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, Ruth in Madison is singing your song.
Well, and look where she's starting out. I mean, she's talking about, she's not going to reach that 80,000. She's talking about, you know, struggling along as the rest of us are, paycheck to paycheck. And that's how this looks to us. You know, it looks to us that we're supporting these people who don't need it. And more than that, we're supporting them. I understand that the payout is progressive, sure, but we're paying out on this tax that stops, I think, it for Social Security at $80,000, so that, you know, Soros doesn't pay taxes on nearly on even an anecdote for him, an hors d'oeuvre. He's all the billions are free. I mean, there's just something there that's galling.
Robert Reichard, what's your sense of the politics? Is this going to come in? We've got Democrats supporting it in addition to Republicans.
I think if Bill comes out of the conference committee, it will be a component of it. But I think that Dean should sigh a little bit of relief, because I think it'll hurt the chances of it ultimately passing.
Dean Baker, do you have the same view, that this is still a kind of poison pill?
I think it's a big uphill struggle, and if you go back to the original bills, you know, they passed by just one vote in the House, and I think it was the same in the Senate, so it doesn't take much to stop it, given, you know, it was just passed originally with the most narrow of margins.
We're talking tonight about means testing and government entitlements, Medicare first of all. You can join the conversation tonight. Affluent listeners, are you ready to pay extra for fundamental government services, or would you feel gouged? And low-income listeners, should the grandma in the Cadillac pay more for her flu shot? Should wealthier Americans bail out Medicare and Social Security? Is that even possible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Robert Reichauer, president of the Urban Institute, Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Public Research. You can join the conversation. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about means testing and government entitlements, starting with Medicare. It's on the table in Congress right now, even this evening as we speak. You can join our conversation tonight. Should wealthier Americans pay out more to help bail out Medicare and maybe one day Social Security? Is that even possible? And if they're asked to, will that somehow pull down the whole show? Are we tampering with a core American compact, social contract here, or just being realistic? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Hal's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Hal. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Good evening. Listen, I just want to say that I make over $100,000 a year.
Okay.
And you know, I married my wife 34 years ago when I was 22. She put me through school. We bought used cars. I just bought a used car. I'm 56, and I just bought a used car this year.
Yep.
I've saved my money. I work on my houses. I did a night school, worked part-time, did a night school MBA, and I have a small business, and it's successful.
So you worked hard for your money, and you're not living like a king.
That's correct. And, you know, the thought right now, I'll just describe this. As an independent businessman, I pay 50% of my income in taxes. Absolutely between $10,000 for property taxes and 7% for the state of Wisconsin, et cetera.
So, Hal, if you retire and you're asked to pay more for some of your medical coverage, will you consider that fair or not?
Well, no, I don't. I don't consider it fair. I currently pay $8,400 a year for my wife and myself for medical insurance with $3,300 deductible. And, you know, the fact of the matter is I will have assets, a large amount of assets, but they're things like houses, which are not income-producing assets.
Right.
So I basically will not be able to retire the rest of my life if I have to pay. And, you know, some of the people that have been calling and talking are up in the ozone. There's only one Warren Buffett. There's only one. There's only one Bill Gates. We're talking about tripling the cost of Medicare coverage to people making $80,000 a year, which is, a small number of us.
So you're saying don't portray me as a Bill Gates. Robert Reichauer, jump in here.
No,
I have no money.
We aren't talking about that. What we're saying is when you retire, if you have an income of $85,000, you might see your contribution to Medicare premiums rise by maybe 5%. It's only if you have an income of $200,000 or over that the contribution, the premium that you pay would triple.
So it's progressive even over the threshold.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Hal, could you see a 5% increase to make this work?
Well, I thought one of the people said it would triple.
It would if you're at a much higher income level.
Yeah, if you have an income $200,000 or over.
What do you think, Hal?
In retirement.
In retirement, if it goes up 5%, that's one thing. However, I'm deeply concerned that it will go up over 5%. I mean, I believe in the future we're going to see, as soon as this goes, Social Security will push to a need-based item also.
Actually, if I could just carry through on where these cutoffs are, because, again, going back to the situation Bob Reichauer described earlier, where we, in effect, leave this cutoff threshold at $80,000.
And then inflation does its work. It becomes essentially a lower figure in real dollars.
Exactly. So this gentleman that Hal, when he's, you know, let's say his income today, if he were to retire today, it'd be $80,000 today's dollars. If we're looking 15, 20 years out, he might be up there at $160,000 paying, in other words, the 150% increase.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to be straight on what we're looking at here.
So you, that would support Hal's kind of fear. Look, this is going to eat into me over time.
That's right. That's right. That's the situation. If we want to raise any real money on this, we have to be taking a fair bit of money from someone like Hal.
Hal, what's your sense at this point? Are you counting on these full benefits, or do you think that the wood chipper's coming at your benefits?
Well, you know, what occurs is I don't go to the doctor. People.
Well, but Hal, just to get this very personal, you said you're paying $8,400 a year for your coverage now.
That's correct.
If you were on Medicare, you would be paying $720, and you wouldn't have a $3,400 deductible that you were talking about. You'd have a $100 deductible for doctor's visits in Part B, and you'd have about an $800 deductible for hospitalization. So you would, in effect, even if I tripled your premium, which I wouldn't do if you had an $85,000 income in retirement, you would still be a heck of a lot better off with respect to health care than you are today.
Yes, that's
as a
true.
Worker.
That's true.
Better off than today, but not as well off as you would be if the current system stayed in place.
No.
And that's the point. So it's all about figuring out the sacrifices here. Hal, thanks for calling and laying out that picture for us. Dan is calling from Boston. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
A couple of things. One is $200,000 in the U.S. isn't the same in Iowa as it is in Boston. And so when you get into a means test, the idea that a specific number means the same to everybody is really not the situation. Like the previous caller, if you live in Boston, you make $200,000 a year, and the Democrats want you to pay more in taxes, and the Democrats want you to pick up more of the medicine than the Democrats, it's insidious and it's really disingenuous. At the end of the day, you know, can you continue to charge us more money? Yeah, but why aren't you really looking at the cause of it, which is really the cost of it? So if you go in and have a blood test, you get a worker who gets $18 an hour, $60 an hour, and the blood test costs you $470 for basically 5 minutes.
So you're saying, look, you can't effectively means test fairly across the country. Look at health care costs themselves.
Well, you can live in Phoenix for 40% less than you can in Boston.
Yeah, we've got that picture. We've got it. Dan, thanks very much for your call. Dean Baker, how about it? I mean, does this have to be solved through controlling health care costs? That has not been a very successful endeavor.
Well, every other nation in the world has managed to do this. And I remember I was on a panel with Bob Reichard a couple of years ago, and we were looking at some projections of health care, actually it was drug spending from the Congressional Budget Office. And he's going, these are ridiculous. We're not going to see them. And I sure hope he's right, but the point is the projections that we're looking at for Medicare for drug costs are astronomical. I said before that we're looking at 14% of our GDP going to health care. The projections from the Congressional Budget Office are that in 10 years out, it'll be 17%. Mm. If we actually see that, you know, we could means test, we could do whatever, we're not going to be able to cover this.
And I'm looking here, Bruce Reed, who was Bill Clinton's former chief domestic advisor. He's now president of the Democratic Leadership Council. He says there is every indication that the conservatives who are pushing this, that is means testing, would like to see Medicare send Medicare down the slippery slope. But he says, Dean Baker, but the bigger slippery slope is that Medicare is on is bankruptcy. Now, you pushed back very hard against that at the top of the hour. Do you see, and here's, of course, a Democrat saying that, but do you see that kind of language, that characterization as a battering ram to knock down the program itself? Is that your fear?
I think so. I mean, whenever I have discussions of this, and I actually have it right here, the Medicare trustees report, I go around, here are the numbers. And, you know, there is a problem with Medicare. There is a problem with Social Security. We're getting older. You know, that's usually thought to be a good thing. I mean, we're living longer. That does raise costs. That's been happening ever since those programs have been in existence. There is another problem with Medicare that's not true of Social Security, that it's picking up health care costs from basically a health care system that's out of control.
Robert Reichard, to you, do you see a kind of backdoor effort to dismantle programs here, or is this just coming to grips with a big problem?
I don't see this as dismantling the programs. I agree with what was said previously, which is that these programs are such a core part of our nation, and we're talking about nibbling around the edges, that the political support will remain to keep these programs pretty much the way they are now. Dean is, of course, right that the real underlying problem is the rise of healthcare costs in this country, but we don't seem to have an answer to how to do that. And in the meantime, let's make sure that we preserve what's good about these programs and the security they can offer to the aged by shoring up their financing with the little bits and pieces that are available.
A new scale of problem and new solutions on the table. Robert Reichard, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Pleasure.
Robert Reichard is president of the Urban Institute. And Dean Baker, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Jack Beatty, Congress is going to have a big debate on its hands.
It is, and it's going to be a big part of the future, and I think we're going to hear a lot of these words of Franklin Roosevelt. With those taxes in there, no damn politician can ever scrap my Social Security program.
Well, we shall see. Jack, thanks for being with us. In a moment, how spam is affecting Americans' internet behavior. This is On Point. last week saw two important milestones in the fight against Internet spam, those unwanted, unsolicited emails that cram your inbox. First, California fined a pair of spammers $2 million, the first financial penalties under the state's five-year-old anti-spam law. Then, the U.S. Senate passed the first-ever federal anti-spam legislation, though the bill faces an uncertain future in the House. A new study shows that spam is beginning to affect Americans' online behavior. Deb Fallows is a senior researcher with the Pew Internet and American Life Project, which conducted the study. In this radio diary, she explains why Americans hate their spam.
There are a number of things about the spam that really bother people. One is a reliability issue, that they just don't trust anymore that their email will either be received or will get through to the recipient unfailingly. About 30% of people worried that important emails wouldn't reach their inboxes. And they also, about half of the people told us that sometimes there was so much clutter in their inboxes with the spam that they were worried that they would lose things themselves, that they just couldn't kind of cut through all the clutter to find the important things there. The other thing that came through very strongly was a sense of deception. It used to be in the olden days, maybe, 2 years ago, that you could pretty much trust if you looked at the sender line, you knew who it was coming from. If you looked at the subject line, you knew what it was about. But now everybody knows that spammers are out there to just try to get you to open that email. So they send emails to you under false pretenses. And people just don't trust that an email coming into their inbox anymore is likely to be what it says it should be. About a quarter of the users told us that they were actually using email less because of the spam. Often it was a sense of critical mission. If there was a message they thought was really important and it had to get through, in some cases they would pick up the phone instead of send an email. In other cases, parents would say that they used to leave the computer on in the family room where the kids could wander back and forth and check their email and so forth, but now they worried if kids went by and clicked on their email that some offensive porn might pop up. So they weren't leaving those computers on anymore, and they were just doing email less, and they were even going so far sometimes as to shut down their kids' accounts or certainly monitor them more closely. So it wasn't as kind of open and freewheeling a situation as it had been before. The other thing I think is just people were getting to the point of being a bit fed up, so that it wasn't like a wonderful experience anymore that you looked forward to, oh, I'm going to open my email and see what's there, or I think I'll send a message to my cousin. But rather, people were approaching this with much more trepidation and sense of duty and thinking, oh, I got to check my email now, and kind of brace themselves for what they were going to find in their inboxes. We had one wonderful guy who wrote in his strategy of how he was going to deal with his spam. He said he got so much that he just didn't know what to do with his inbox. It was so overloaded. So he decided he would put on a blacklist to send straight to his junk mail folder the five or six people he really wanted to hear from. And whenever incoming messages came from those people, it automatically went to his junk mail folder. And then he just started operating out of his junk mail folder, and he completely turned his inbox over to the spam that was there. So that was one of the more ingenious methods, kind of homebrewed methods of dealing with the spam that we had heard about. Despite all of the stories that people tell us about their spam and how much it bothers them and how difficult it is to find workarounds for the spam, the interesting counterpart to that is that people really do have this in perspective. Most people tell us that they're just plain annoyed by spam. They just put it in the category of an annoyance in life, like telemarketing calls. I think the reason for this is that people really love email. They really love the idea of having this application that is so wonderful on the web, and they're trying to do everything they can to get around the spam to keep it as a viable thing going.
Deb Fallows is a senior research fellow with the Pew Internet and American Life Project. She lives in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Spam, 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 spam